works and is the bane of all military men, to whom the sanctity of the chain of command is basic and the idea of two disagreeing commanders in a critical situation is anathema. But Lewis did it anyway. It must have felt right to him. It had to have been based on what he knew about Clark and what he felt for him. Lewis wanted Clark along, even if not as an official member of the party. He closed his letter by saying that, if personal or business or any other affairs prevented Clark from accepting, Lewis hoped that he could accompany me as a friend part of the way up the Missouri. I should be extremely happy in your company. It would take a month for Lewis's letter to reach Clark, another 10 days for his reply to arrive. Meanwhile, a mystery. 10 days after Lewis made his offer of a shared command to Clark, he received from Secretary Dearborn the advance pay for the party to be recruited. It authorized one lieutenant only. Lewis made no known protest. Jefferson should have been alert enough to notice that Dearborn was thinking lieutenant while Lewis was offering captain, and he should have corrected the situation by telling Dearborn that Lewis's offer would prevail, and Clark, if he accepted, would be a captain. But the commander-in-chief did nothing. It was uncharacteristic of Lewis and Jefferson to miss a detail of any kind, much less one fraught with such potential danger for embarrassment, misunderstanding, and bad feeling, but they missed this one. Lewis spent the last week of June buying supplies and instruments, gathering more books, and going over maps. He made arrangements for a stand-in as his fellow officer, should Clark decline. He chose a man he had met in 1799 and served with, Lieutenant Moses Hook, and assured Jefferson that Hook was the best officer in the Army. Endowed with a good constitution, possessing a sensible, well-informed mind, is industrious, prudent, and persevering, and withal intrepid and enterprising. Lewis didn't hand out praise easily, and since it was clear that he was ready to cross the continent with Hook, he obviously meant what he said about Hook's superior abilities. But there was no hint of a promotion to captain and a co-command. Good as Hook was, he wasn't William Clark. By July 2nd, Lewis was nearing completion of the preparations and about to set off for Pittsburgh. That day, he wrote his mother. He opened with an apology for not having the time to come home for a visit before departing for the Western country, a trip he expected to take about a year and a half. As boys setting off on an adventure are wont to do, he reassured his mother. The nature of this expedition is by no means dangerous. My route will be altogether through tribes of Indians who are perfectly friendly to the United States. Therefore, consider the chances of life just as much in my favor on this trip as I should conceive them were I to remain at home. After telling his mother not to worry, he wrote of what being Mr. Jefferson's choice meant to him. The charge of this expedition is honorable to myself as it is important to my country. Then it was back to reassurance. I feel myself perfectly prepared, nor do I doubt my health and strength of constitution to bear me through it. I go with the most perfect preconviction in my own mind of returning safe, and hope, therefore, that you will not suffer yourself to indulge any anxiety for my safety. There followed a series of instructions on the education of Lewis's half-brother, John Marks. Lewis insisted that John go to the College of William and Mary at Williamsburg, even if land certificates had to be sold to pay the tuition. Given how deeply Virginia planters hated to sell land, Lewis's priorities show the high value he set on education. After the crash courses he had been put through in Philadelphia, he had reason to wish he had gone to college. He closed with a wish to be remembered to various members of the family, especially the two youngsters, Mary and Jack. Tell them I hope the progress they will make in their studies will be equal to my wishes. Also on July 2nd, Dearborn handed Lewis the authorization to select up to 12 non-commissioned officers and privates. He could pick them from the garrisons at the posts at Massac and Kaskaskia, the former on the lower Ohio and the latter on the Mississippi, above the mouth of the Ohio. In separate orders, Dearborn told the commanding officers at the posts to furnish Lewis with every assistance in selecting and engaging suitable men to accompany him on an expedition to the westward. That was a license to raid, sure to be resented by captains about to lose their best men, but Dearborn made it stick. If any man in your company should be disposed to join Captain Lewis, and if Captain Lewis wanted the volunteer, you will detach them accordingly. In addition, Captain Russell Bissell at Kaskaskia was ordered to provide Lewis with the best boat on the post, and with a sergeant and 8 good men who understand rowing a boat. They would carry baggage for Lewis to his winter quarters on the Missouri, then descend before the ice closed in. Bissell refused Sergeant Patrick Gass's request to join the expedition, presumably on the grounds that he couldn't afford to lose his best non-commissioned officer. Lewis used the authority given him by Dearborn to enlist Gass anyway. For the descent of the Ohio, Lieutenant Colonel Thomas Cushing provided Lewis with 8 recruits from the post at Carlisle, Pennsylvania. In a pouch accompanying the order, Cushing included a couple of dozen letters for Lewis to deliver to officers at the western posts. He asked Lewis, after he reached St. Louis, to send the 8 recruits down the Mississippi to Fort Adams. Cushing closed with a nice note. "That your expedition may be pleasant to yourself and advantageous to our country, and when its toils and dangers are over, that you may enjoy many years of happiness, prosperity, and honor, is the sincere wish of, sir, your most obedient servant." July 4, 1803, the nation's 27th birthday, was a great day for Meriwether Lewis. He completed his preparations and was ready to depart in the morning. He got his letter of credit in its final form from President Jefferson, and the National Intelligencer of Washington reported in that day's issue that Napoleon had sold Louisiana to the United States. It was stunning news of the most fundamental importance. Henry Adams put it best. "The annexation of Louisiana was an event so portentous as to defy measurement. It gave a new face to politics and ranked in historical importance next to the Declaration of Independence and the adoption of the Constitution, events of which it was the logical outcome. But as a matter of diplomacy, it was unparalleled because it costs almost nothing." Napoleon's decision to sell not just New Orleans but all of Louisiana, and the negotiations that followed, and Jefferson's decision to waive his strict constructionist views in order to make the purchase, is a dramatic and well-known story. It is best described by Henry Adams in his History of the United States in the Administrations of Thomas Jefferson, one of the great classics of American history writing. Napoleon was delighted, and rightly so. He had title to Louisiana, but no power to enforce it. The Americans were sure to overrun it long before he could get an army there, if he ever could. 60 million francs for an occupation that will not perhaps last a day," he exulted. He knew what he was giving up and what the United States was getting, and the benefit to France beyond the money. "The sale assures forever the power of the United States, and I have given England a rival who sooner or later will humble her pride." For Lewis, what mattered was not how Louisiana was acquired, a process in which he played no role, but that the territory he would be crossing from the Mississippi to the Continental Divide now belonged to the United States. As Jefferson nicely put it, the Louisiana purchase lessened the apprehensions of interruption from other powers. The purchase did more for the expedition than relieve it of threats from the Spanish, French, or British. As Jefferson noted, it increased infinitely the interest we felt in the expedition. When Adams wrote that the purchase gave a new face to politics, he meant that it signified the end of the Federalist Party, which was so short-sighted and partisan that many of its representatives criticized the act. Alexander Hamilton was wise to content himself with remarking that Jefferson had just been lucky. The purchase, he said, resulted from the kind interpositions of an overruling providence. But a Boston Federalist newspaper did not like the deal at all. It called Louisiana a great waste, a wilderness unpeopled with any beings except wolves and wandering Indians. We are to give money of which we have too little for land of which we already have too much. Jefferson was risking national bankruptcy to buy a desert. Angry partisanship was the order of the day. Senator John Quincy Adams complained in his diary, "The country is so totally given up to the spirit of party that not to follow blindfold the one or the other is an inexpiable offense." But the New England Federalists were putting themselves on the wrong side of history to oppose the purchase. One denounced it as a great curse, and another feared that the purchase threatens, at no very distant day, the subversion of our Union. Caspar Wister of Philadelphia, Lewis's sometime tutor, got it right. He wrote to congratulate Jefferson, on the very happy acquisitions you have made for our country. Although no one here appears to know the extent or price of the cession, it is generally considered as the most important and beneficial transaction which has occurred since the Declaration of Independence, and next to it, most like to influence or regulate the destinies of our country. One immediate effect of the purchase was to change Lewis's relationship with the Indian tribes he would encounter east of the Divide. The Indians were now on American territory. Lewis would be responsible for informing them that their great father was Jefferson rather than the Spanish and French rulers. Jefferson wanted Lewis to bring them into the trading net of the United States, which meant bringing peace among them and telling the British around the Mandan villages that they were on foreign soil. By far, the most important effect of the purchase on the expedition was a negative that stemmed from the fact that no one knew what the boundaries of Louisiana were. Napoleon sold Louisiana with the same extent that it now has in the hands of Spain and that it had when France possessed it. The general belief was that Louisiana consisted of the western half of the Mississippi drainage. That meant from the Gulf of Mexico northward to the northernmost tributaries of the Missouri, and from the Mississippi westward to the Continental Divide. But no American, Spaniard, Frenchman, or Briton knew how far north that was. Jefferson, greatly excited by the prospect of adding more northern territory to the purchase, at once began urging Lewis to explore those northern tributaries, where earlier, in the formal instructions, he had emphasized exploration of the southern tributaries. Jefferson wanted land. He wanted empire. He reached out to seize what he wanted, first of all by continually expanding the boundaries of Louisiana. Diplomatic historian Thomas Maitland Marshall describes it well. Starting with the idea that the purchase was confined to the western waters of the Mississippi Valley, Jefferson's conception had gradually expanded until, by 1808, it included West Florida, Texas, and the Oregon Country, a view which was to be the basis of a large part of American diplomacy for nearly half a century. Lewis started out for Pittsburgh on July 5, 1803, the day after the news of the purchase arrived. Although he was in a good mood, he had a great deal to be worried about. Would Clark accept, or would his health or business commitments prevent him from joining? Had the wagon load of supplies gotten from Philadelphia to Pittsburgh? Had the weapons and other items selected at Harper's Ferry been sent to Pittsburgh? Had he selected the right items in sufficient quantity? What kind of soldiers would be meeting him in Pittsburgh for the trip down the Ohio? Was the keelboat he had ordered made in Pittsburgh completed? He had a sense of urgency. Having used up more than a month of good traveling weather, he knew the Ohio River would be falling as summer wore on, knew that he had to get going if he were to have any hope of making any significant distance up the Missouri before the weather closed in. But he still had a great deal to do in Harper's Ferry and Pittsburgh. So he could not have been altogether easy in his mind as he turned his horse's head west and started out. But he must have had a joy in his heart. He certainly had a determination. With that first step west, he intended never to look back until he had reached the Pacific. Lewis got to Fredericktown, present Frederick, Maryland, the evening of July 5th. There was good news. The wagon carrying supplies from Philadelphia had passed through Fredericktown 10 days earlier. There was bad news. On arrival at Harper's Ferry, the driver had decided the arms and other weapons Lewis had ordered were too heavy for his team, so he had gone on to Pittsburgh without them. Lewis hired a teamster in Fredericktown, who promised he would be in Harper's Ferry by July 8th. Lewis pushed on to Harper's Ferry, where I shot my guns and examined the several articles which had been manufactured for me at this place. They appeared to be well executed. What pleased him most was the completed iron frame boat. But good feelings gave way to worries. The teamster disappointed me. Lewis hired another, locally. The man promised to load up the guns and the iron frame and the rest and be on his way to Pittsburgh early the next morning. Lewis then set off for Pittsburgh, where he arrived at 2 o'clock p.m. on July 15th. He immediately wrote a report to Jefferson so as to catch the 5 o'clock p.m. post. It had been hot and dry, the roads extremely dusty, yet I feel myself much benefited by the exercise the journey has given me, and can with pleasure announce, so far, and all is well. Though the Ohio was low, it could be navigated if he could get a quick start. He had not yet had time to see the boat he had ordered. The boat contract called for completion on July 20th, but to Lewis's intense disappointment, the builder wasn't even close to done. The contractor claimed he had found it difficult to get the proper timber, but now it had arrived, and he promised to have the work completed by July 30th. Lewis reported to Jefferson that he was by no means sanguine that he could meet that date. August 5th was more like it. "I visit him every day," Lewis wrote, "and endeavor by every means in my power to hasten the completion of the work. I have prevailed on him to engage more hands. I shall embark immediately. The boat is in readiness." Some good news. The wagon from Harper's Ferry arrived on July 22nd. So had the party of 7 recruits. The 8th recruit had pocketed his bounty for enlisting and promptly deserted, from Carlisle, who would make the descent of the Ohio with the keelboat. But what nagged was the falling river. "The current of the Ohio is extremely low and continues to decline," Lewis told Jefferson. "This may impede my progress, but shall not prevent my proceeding, being determined to get forward, though I should not be able to make a greater distance than a mile per day." The next week was agony for Lewis. The boat builder was a drinking man, so he seldom worked mornings, and sometimes not in the afternoons either. He had none of Lewis's sense of urgency, but there was no one else in Pittsburgh capable of doing the work. So Lewis fretted and fumed, but did not fire the contractor. On July 29th, the mail brought in the best possible news. It was a letter from Clark. He had accepted. "The enterprise, etc., is such as I have long anticipated and am much pleased with," Clark wrote, "and as my situation in life will admit of my absence the length of time necessary to accomplish such an undertaking, I will cheerfully join you in an official character, as mentioned in your letter, and partake of the dangers, difficulties, and fatigues, and I anticipate the honors and rewards of the result of such an enterprise. This is an undertaking freighted with many difficulties, but, my friend, I do assure you that no man lives with whom I would prefer to undertake such a trip, etc., as yourself." He asked Lewis to tell Jefferson to send his commission on to Louisville, across the river from Clarksville. He said he would try to find a few good men for the expedition, which he reported was the chief subject of conversation in Louisville. In a follow-up letter of July 24th, Clark related that "several young men, gentlemen's sons, have applied to accompany us, as they are not accustomed to labor, and as that is a very essential part of the services required of the party, I am cautious in giving them any encouragement." He told Lewis he would be ready to go as soon as the keelboat reached Louisville, for he too was eager to get as far up the Missouri as possible that season. "My friend," he concluded, "I join you with hand and heart." "I feel myself much gratified with your decision," Lewis told Clark by the next post, August 3rd, "for I could neither hope, wish, or expect from a union with any man on earth more perfect support or further aid in the discharge of the several duties of my mission than that which I am confident I shall derive from being associated with yourself." Lewis said he was pleased that Clark had engaged some men and reminded him that this was their most critical job. "The enterprise must depend on a judicious selection of our men. Their qualifications should be such as perfectly fit them for the service. Otherwise, they will rather clog than further the objects in view. On this principle, I am well pleased that you have not admitted or encouraged the young gentlemen you mention. We must set our faces against all such applications and get rid of them on the best terms we can. They will not answer our purposes." Clark absolutely agreed. On August 21st, he informed Lewis that, "I have had many applications from stout, likely fellows, but have refused to retain some and put others off with the promise of giving an answer after I see or heard from you." Lewis was simultaneously being pestered by young men in Pittsburgh who wanted to join up. Clearly, the word was out in the Western country, and what young, unmarried frontiersmen, whether gentlemen's sons or the sons of whiskey-making corn farmers, could resist such an opportunity? It was the ultimate adventure. The reward for success would be a land grant, similar to those given the Revolutionary War veterans, a princely reward to frontiersmen. So Lewis and Clark could be highly selective. Clark was an excellent judge of men. He had gathered 7 of the best young woodsmen and hunters in this part of the country. These were the men awaiting Lewis's approval before being accepted. They included Charles Floyd, Nathaniel Pryor, William Bratton, Reuben Field, Joseph Field, George Gibson, and John Shields. Lewis was equally good as a judge. In Pittsburgh, he selected John Coulter and George Shannon, at 18 the youngest of the group, subject to Clark's approval. The boatbuilder was guilty of unpardonable negligence, Lewis charged. August 5th came and went, and only one side of the boat was partially planked. In desperation, Lewis thought of purchasing two or three pirogues. It is impossible to tell what he meant by this, as he used the words pirogue and canoe interchangeably. A pirogue is a flat-bottomed dugout designed for marshes and shallow waters, most popular today among Louisiana duck hunters. The pirogues Lewis had in mind, however, were much larger, and possibly not dugouts at all, but big flat-bottomed masted rowboats built from planks. A canoe is a round or curved bottom craft, either dug out of the trunk of a large tree or built to a frame and covered with bark or skins, most popular today for recreation on large, fast rivers. When Lewis said canoe, however, what he meant was a round-bottomed dugout much larger than today's sporting canoes. In his anxiety to get going, and with his doubts that the boatbuilder would ever complete the keelboat, Lewis was proposing to descend the Ohio River in pirogues until he could find a keelboat somewhere downriver to purchase. But when the local merchants told him there was no place to procure a boat below, and the boatbuilder promised to be done by August 13th, Lewis abandoned the fantasy.